ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Natalie Kogan, a tech entrepreneur who came to the U.S. after escaping the former Soviet Union at age 13. Since then, she's worked with McKinsey and Microsoft, become one of the youngest female venture capitalists in New York City, and had a baby, all before she turned 30. Most recently, Natalie launched her app, Happier, 5 years ago, and her book, Happier Now, was released on May 1st of this year. Hi, Natalie. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's begin with a little bit of background on your career because it's pretty unique. Can you give us the, for listeners who aren't familiar with you, the Cliff Notes version of you and who you are?
Sure. Well, the career portion of me is that I started out my career at McKinsey & Company in New York. I was an analyst and then considered that my MBA program as well. And was really eager to take all that learning into doing. And I joined a couple early stage startups right in the storm of the first market crash. So it was a good learning experience. And was pitching one of those companies to raise money from a venture capital firm when I got into a really interesting interaction with one of the lead partners, which led me to kind of having to stand up and assert my ground, and got a surprise call from that partner after the meeting telling me that the company was probably not going to make it. He was right. We didn't have a lot of market share. But that's how I became a venture capitalist at the age of 26. I became a managing director at a venture capital firm in New York. I believe at the time there were 6% women in the industry. I think we're now up to 10. Woohoo! Some improvement. Something. And so I had a 5-year career as a venture capitalist, learned a tremendous amount. My favorite investment that I love to brag about for them, not for me, is a company called Constant Contact, which is a $1 billion company that has since gone public. I invested in Constant Contact when there were 20 employees in a little conference room up here near Boston with, I think, 2,000 customers. They have 700,000 today. So I learned a lot. And then after my career in VC, I kind of got the itch to, you know, I loved working with entrepreneurs, but I didn't love being a VC. And I wanted to do, so I left to the dismay of my immigrant parents. And I'm happy to talk about my background. I grew up in Russia, but I left that very fantastic, hard to get job. And I launched a series of startups. I launched a company for working moms called Work at Mom. It was the first, became the largest kind of online networking site and content site for working moms. We ended up selling that. I then spent some time with a social innovation lab at Microsoft. I ran consumer experience for a mobile company here in Boston called Wear, which we sold to PayPal. And then through a journey I never expected, I became the founder and CEO of a company called Happier, which is what I do now, and which I founded after my own struggle to find any sense of lasting contentment and happiness, and with the mission to help millions of people use these very simple but scientifically backed practices to boost their happier skills, because I look at happiness as a skill. So that's as short as I can make it.
Well, so obviously you're a real slacker, really not a doer. That's always been your challenge, obviously.
It's always been my issue, yeah.
So obviously you've achieved some more. And what's interesting, what I find especially interesting is it's at that point where you are the founder and CEO of Happier, and you have all this information about the science behind the skill set of happiness, but then you hit a rough patch, right?
Yeah, and very unexpected, you know, so just because this is relevant to all of this. So I grew up in the former Soviet Union, and my parents and I became refugees. We escaped and to try and come to the United States when I was 13. And after several months in refugee settlements in Europe, we were given permission to come to the U.S. and we started our lives here in the projects outside of Detroit, you know, very grateful to have welfare and food stamps to get started. And I mention this because it's so relevant because this is where really my drive for achievement came from, because, you know, we were very excited to be in America, but as a 13-year-old, I mean, I was lost. I hardly spoke English. Everyone made fun of me. I kind of lost my identity as a smart kid and a good student, and I was just overwhelmed with so much self-doubt and fear, and the only times that I felt good is when I achieved something, you know, when I got out of remedial English classes and started taking regular, or when I started doing better in school, or, you know, when I then graduated at the top of my high school class and in college. And so I really saw achievement as kind of twofold. One, I really felt good every time I achieved something. There was this happiness bubble around it. And the second thing is I wanted to achieve as much as possible to kind of honor the gift that I was given to build my life in America. And that's kind of what fueled my non-slacker achievement drive. And so what I didn't expect is that a couple years into what I would consider my greatest achievement, which is launching Happier, and we launched first with a mobile app to help people practice the scientifically proven habit of gratitude. We had hundreds of thousands of users. We were changing lives. I was giving, you know, I gave a hugely popular TEDx talk here in Boston. I was on the front page of the New York Times tech section. And I never expected that when I achieved these great moments that really made me feel like, okay, I'm doing enough with, you know, this gift of being an American, when I would hit my darkest time. And, you know, in fact, I say, and I'll say this to you and your listeners, that day when the New York Times featured us in their business section was one of the darkest days of my life. I'm not sure I came home that day. And I had a daughter. I have a daughter. She's 13 now. She was about 10 then, and a husband and a family. And I became almost catatonic. And what happened in retrospect, I didn't quite get it at the time. And of course, I did the CEO thing of denying anything was wrong. And it was obvious to everyone around me something was wrong, but I couldn't afford sharing reality with people. But what became obvious pretty quickly is that all this drive to achieve, in all this drive, I never allowed myself to be kind to myself. I berated myself for every mistake I made. I was so harsh with myself. And this is eventually what kind of caused my breakdown. And I can assure you, 3 years ago, the words kind to myself or self-compassion would be something I would be allergic to, because I was a fighter. I was tough. I was an immigrant. And, you know, look at everything I've done. And, you know, this is a topic of an op-ed I wrote that the Washington Post published, is that all this grit and overachieving, it eventually almost cost me everything. And that was a very scary place to be.
Right. So here you are. And, you know, what do you think it was being on the cover of the business section that was this darkest of all moments? I mean,
so that part was fantastic and brilliant and amazing, and it helped launch Happier, but it's how I felt that day. It wasn't about the cover. It's that on the outside, my life was amazing. You know,
but you didn't feel it inside.
But I was a hardly functioning human. I mean, I was a terrible CEO. I could hardly make a decision. And that's like the number one thing you do as a CEO. I wasn't really there in any part of my life. I was, you know, hardly present as a mom. Some of my most painful memories from that time is that I was really kind of the zombie with my family. And I was just caught in this like vicious cycle of self-doubt and self-recrimination and just unable to function. And that's a really scary place to be for an overachiever, for someone who's always relied on her achievements as a way to feel joy. And as someone who feels like, oh my God, I'm the CEO of a company called Happier. How in the world am I feeling this way?
Well, I was wondering if, I mean, oftentimes women executives, women entrepreneurs run into imposter syndrome. And if there was an element of, I can't have this problem because my entire business is about having cracked what this is.
Of course, it was that. And even kind of, you know, I write in my book, it's even kind of deeper than that. I think the way I write about it is exactly how I felt, is that I kind of felt like, am I just total fraud? Right? Mm-hmm. Like every week I write an email to a couple hundred thousand people who, you know, like my advice. And this company is something that is in the lives of so many people. And I can't seem to come out of this. Am I just a total fraud? And what are people going to do when they find out that I feel like this? So absolutely.
So once you came to terms with it for yourself and you discovered that you really did need to be kind to yourself and allow yourself to explore that, how did you communicate that with your company? What was the sort of coming out of this truth How did that work?
I love that the words that you used coming out, because this is how I think about my book, is it's a coming out. And I started with ginger steps, tiny, tiny steps. When I turned 40, I was about a year into kind of my trying to find my way out of this darkness. And I made a commitment to myself that one of the practices I was making part of my life was to learn to accept all kinds of emotions, that kind of I've redefined what it means to be happier, to really allow myself to also be okay with not being okay. And in fact, it became one of the core practices that I now teach as part of my work. And so as part of that commitment, I said that in these emails that I send to the happier community, I am going to start to open up a little bit about some of the struggle. Mm-hmm. And I did. And it was one of the scariest things I've ever done. I mean, mm-hmm. a CEO of Happier sending an email to 250,000 people telling them, actually, I've been really struggling. But so that's how I did it. And I can tell you this became the impetus for the book, because what came back to me, the only way I can describe it, and I think this is how I say it in the book, it felt like this giant collective hug and genuine human love. I don't mean romantic love. I don't mean that, but enormous outpouring of both support and also, and this is why I wrote the book, this thousands of people saying, oh my God, you sharing that makes me feel like I have hope because I'm struggling too. And the fact that a CEO of Happier struggles, right, and you can open up about it, like that gives me hope that I can also get through this. And that's what it was. And it was incredibly powerful. It didn't make it any less scary, by the way. And it's still, you know, the book is just out and, you know, I get contacted all the time from the members of the community, business colleagues who are like, oh my God, I had no idea. But that was a big lesson for me in owning our truth, as you say, and coming out as our true selves. We're afraid to do this as women executives, as executives, you know, we think we have to be strong, confident, and everything is amazing. But actually what I have learned, and I keep learning it, because, you know, now I get on stages in front of 2,000-3,000 executives and I talk about this, is nobody runs away from us and no one considers us weak and no one gives up on us. It's quite the opposite. So that was a really powerful learning for me.
Well, yeah. I mean, I imagine the authenticity of the moment really resonated with people. I'm curious then, did you adjust and change the app that you had created and the messaging? I mean, obviously your speaking engagements, the messaging has expanded and the story has evolved, but the company, the app, how it incorporates this new feeling about the sort of full range of emotions. So that had to adjust as well. Yes.
Absolutely. So I will tell you that we haven't changed the app. So the app really, you know, we built it to practice gratitude and kindness and to capture and share moments of gratitude and kindness. And that's what it was designed for. So the app is still free and, you know, people continue to use it. What shifted dramatically was what I now call our happier method. And so instead of focusing just on gratitude and kindness, there's actually now 5 core happier skills that we talk about and teach. And we teach it. We have a course. We launched a happier at work program where we do back-to-back workshops where we teach employees and leaders these 5 core happier skills. And so it's gone from 2 things, gratitude and kindness, to 5. And the first one is acceptance. And it's both acceptance of reality and acceptance and embracing of all kinds of difficult emotions, because research, by the way, shows when we accept and acknowledge our difficult emotions, we get through them with a little more ease. And so we've added, and another skill is connecting to a sense of meaning. And then finally, self-care and self-compassion, which is what I was missing. So we've dramatically expanded and I would say deepened our methodology. That's where the Happier at Work program came from, because at my speaking engagements, executives would come and talk to me about this. And we saw a huge need for this in the workplace. So we've been piloting the program and we're rolling it out now to a bunch of companies because it's been really successful. So I would say while the app has stayed true to its origins of gratitude and kindness, the entire company has now shifted based on my experience. And we've deepened our methodology and we're bringing it to people in a different way, focusing on happier at work. So it was a huge shift in how I think about happiness and the skills involved in it and the depth of what we can offer.
So that's interesting. One of the questions I was going to ask is it possible to create happiness in an organization, a culture of happiness?
Oh,
so is
yes,
that
it is.
that's sort of what you're talking about then.
That is the primary focus right now because, I mean, and you know, we've all, I think, heard these scary numbers. 85% of employees in America are either stressed or overwhelmed. Only 30% are engaged with their jobs. And that creates all sorts of, not just unhappiness in them as individuals, but that's a serious organizational issue. And there's so much research that shows that happier employees are more productive, more creative, they're better at customer service, they're more innovative, they work better as teams, and actually companies with happier employees are more profitable. And so what we are focusing on now is our Happier at Work program, because when you start to look at this as a skill, which is our foundation, that happiness is not something you feel, but it's something you do, and all of these skills that we teach are rooted in science, but the workshops that we do in the companies, now they're rooted in science. It's all focused on teaching practical skills, but we do them in teams. We do them in an interactive way. They involve some very unexpected things, Gabriella, like most awesome kindness champion trophies and some really interesting superhero cape stuff. So they're also creative, but the entire purpose of them is to create a culture of gratitude, acceptance, psychological safety, and kindness, which has been shown to dramatically transform productivity and engagement. And so it's absolutely possible. I think that we don't have a choice in our society, but to invest in this, not just from a perspective of, you know, we all spend a lot of time at work, but from the perspective of, it makes us better humans, it makes us better leaders, and it makes for better companies, better performing companies.
One of the things you mentioned that you have a family and you have a daughter who's around the same age that you were when you underwent this great hardship. And a lot of the research today talks about how stressed and unhappy the youth of our country is. Mm. A lot of it is attributed to social platforms and the sort of image management that goes on, and then comparison between my real life and these images I'm seeing. And are you also venturing into that territory, or is that sort of phase two, or just not?
Well, that's
really
my dream. What you just talked about is my dream. So that's definitely phase two once we build the Happier at Work. I mean, my dream is to, and I say this to anyone who will listen, because when you put it out in the universe, somebody will hear it and will partner up. But my dream is to really have a foundation that develops curriculums for our schools. This is something we should be teaching our kids. And I hate when people refer to some of this as soft skills, or like communication as a soft skill. This is essential. There's a mountain of research from some of the most reputable universities in the world that show that when we improve our emotional well-being, we are healthier, we are more productive, we're able to lead more fulfilling lives. And so I don't see this as a bonus, as a choice. This is the foundation that we should be teaching our kids. And my daughter's 13 now. She's going to turn 14 in a few weeks. And I can literally see the just her absorbing, you know, we have a great relationship. I'm really open about what I'm going through. And so she's absorbed some of this from me, even though I'm her mom, which, you know.
Well, that's another layer. That's always challenging.
Which is another layer. But I've seen the benefits. And I see when she shares, you know, she almost does these little lectures to her friends. And I see how eager they are to learn these things. And absolutely. So it's my dream to bring this to our educational institutions so we can actually teach kids as a skill. I can tell you, I don't focus on, because it's not my background, speaking to schools, but I've spoken twice at high schools, and each time, you know, it was 7 in the morning, 700 high school students, and some lady who's going to talk about happiness. I mean, you know, I expected to get egged. Literally, like,
let us sleep and we'll be happy,
right? And it was unbelievable. I mean, first, you know, what I say is, in 10 minutes, I didn't see a single phone up. Do you know what it's like to get 700 high school students to not have their phones out? But they were all in, because they are so stressed out. They are so overwhelmed. All the messages they're getting is do more, do better, be better, be, have grit, fight, fight, fight. Self-care, self-compassion, you're okay as you are, learning how to manage stress. They're not learning this anywhere, and they are desperate. They're desperate to learn it.
Are you seeing any gender differences with regard to happiness and our ability to practice some of these skills? I mean, you mentioned earlier that you hate seeing them labeled as soft skills. Oftentimes, this sort of common mythology is women are stronger at soft skills. Do you find that there is a gender difference, a willingness to to just jump in, or is that not true?
You know, it's a great question. And I'll tell you this, 80% of the happier users of the app are women. And probably we don't have as exact numbers, but I'm going to say 85 to 80% are subscribers to my email are women. So absolutely self-selected for this. But I will tell you, I have had unbelievable experiences, you know, where I'll do a keynote and it's, you know, 1,000 sales executives and it's 95% men. And they are eager. They come to me in tears or they follow up after. And the message that I hear is, I don't have a place in my life where it's okay to have emotions. I don't have a place in my life where it's okay for me to be not okay. No one talks to me about self-care or self-compassion. I taught a course on self-compassion online last year, and I was blown away both by how many men signed up, but also how vocal the men were. We did this like Facebook group as part of the course. How many men were very vocal about, oh my God, this is the only place in my life where I am allowed to say that I feel sad or I'm tired or et cetera. And so I think that in our society, we give women more of a permission to talk about emotions. And I think that men have as much of a need to do it. And so I've seen both. Definitely self-selection, you know, for the app and some of the content is more women, but I think it's just because this is how our society has structured it. You know, a lot of these speaking engagements I give, often if it's a sales conference, you know, some of them are very male dominated. And these are the ones the one I mentioned, the sales conference, I did a 4.5 hour Q&A, a 4.5 hour. My talk is an hour. They did not want to leave. And there were so much of like, oh my God, this is a toolkit I'm learning. So I think these skills are universal. I think we all have the same degree of need to be able to talk about our emotions, including at work. But I think we've made it more open and more okay for women. And I'm excited when I see men come out and want to talk about this, because it's also reinforcement for women that, hey, this is important. Like to your point, this is not a soft skill. This is the foundation of us being able to function as a human being.
Now, this is a health skill. This is a life skill. I'm curious, as a VC, you mentioned the paucity of female VCs. Yeah. But also, you know, I've spoken to other VCs, and one of the things they talk about is the difference between men and women in terms of how they pitch, what they talk about, their willingness, like that women will say what they're going to do, but they don't necessarily communicate the big dream. It sometimes makes it harder. Now, are people who are entrepreneurs, I mean, you talk also about self-selection, are people who are doing this more likely to deny these negative corrosive thoughts because they simply don't want to share, don't want to show, can't be vulnerable? I mean, if you put your head back when you were a VC, how would this have worked, this honesty?
Oh, it's tough. I mean, you went right, nailed right on the head. I mean, I did an interview with Forbes and they published this article and it kind of went viral in the entrepreneur VC community because I basically shared my personal story of my burnout and my crash and as a call to action to VCs to start paying as much attention to the founders' employee well, to their emotional well-being as much as they do to, you know, product market fit, having the right team, having the right board members, because the emotional well-being of the founder in a startup it's not an extra, which is how it's being treated, which is how I was treating it, but it's an essential, it's a required input into a successful business like anything else. And so there is this shame, there is this, well, you're supposed to be tough and you're supposed to be confident, right? And there's been in the last couple of years, unfortunately, an increasing number of public suicides by very high profile entrepreneurs and public admissions by some of the leading VCs about their own struggle with this. And it's so unfortunate, but I welcome the openness because at least there's some of a dialogue. I cannot tell you how many entrepreneurs reached out to me after that article and they said, oh my God, thank you for sharing this. I don't know who I can talk to about this. If I ever admit this to my board that I feel like this, I think they're going to fire me. And so I think that's for men and women, by the way, 100% the same. The men CEOs are as afraid. When it comes to, you know, women and men, you know, in these very male dominated fields like VC, there is a different way to talk about things. I definitely noticed as a VC, I notice it in myself, you know, and this is not my first rodeo, but I notice how I fall into the same stereotypes because the stereotypes exist. But when it comes to emotions and entrepreneurs, what I have found is it's kind of across the board that entrepreneurs feel that we need to be heroes who sleep, you know, every third day for 3 hours like Marissa Mayer and run 17 companies.
Get the nanny, lady, please.
Exactly. While having like, you know, 35 children or however many, like Elon Musk. And Elon Musk, I was at a talk he gave, I was a couple years ago, I think it was at South by Southwest, where somebody asked him, because I didn't know he had 5 children. I'd never read that. He said it. And so someone asked him, like, well, how do you, like, you're running 3 companies, 5 children? He's like, well, you know, I'm amazing at multitasking. I can, like, be with my kids and be on email 100% of the time. And I'm sitting there like, I know where he's coming from, because I used to think that too.
Yeah, but you also just want to, you want to slap him a bit, don't you?
You do.
I mean, because that's such a, that's, you know, that's life, like, nah.
Exactly. I have to share something with you on that note. Just, this is like a non sequitur, but kind of is. I have to share with you what, so when I was in venture capitals, when I became pregnant with my daughter, and it was me and all men at the firm, and I was a managing director, it was 5 partners, there was another managing director, it was a guy. And so, you know, I waited like the most I could wait. I was like 6 months pregnant, and fortunately I'm pretty petite. So, you know, you couldn't, the guys, they, you know, they probably thought I was getting fat. So then finally I, you know, it was fine. So I decided to tell them, and I walk into what, I would just go office by office and share them, and they were excited. So one of the guys, I'm not going to name his name, he kind of was like, oh, well, congratulations to you and Avi, my husband. He said, you know, he has 3 kids, and I knew that they were older. He said, you know, something I'm so proud of, I have 3 kids, and not a single time did I miss a work meeting for a soccer event. And I literally thought he misspoke. You know how you like sometimes say the opposite of what you're saying?
Right.
So I was like, I was about to lean in and be like, oh, you mean, he's like, I am so proud that not a single work meeting was ever missed because I was at a school play or something. And this is what he had to say to me after I told him.
Oh, well, this is a message for you though, isn't it? FYI. Well, this is,
people asked me why I was on conference calls 3 days after I gave birth for work, even though I was on maternity leave. Well, here's why. I thought they were going to fire me.
Well, of course you did with that kind of message. Ugh. Yeah. Well, this is the thing, like saying, you know, oh, I'm great at multitasking. That's like the celebrity who's in the amazing dress after giving birth, and everybody else is like, are you kidding me? I can't do that. My stomach has never been the same. My goodness. Oh, well, we have actually run through very rapidly our time. And before we wrap up entirely, I wanted to know, what is your next greatest goal?
Oh, what a great question. Well, let me be as bold as sometimes I can be when I stop worrying about things in the day-to-day. My next greatest goal is to make our emotional well-being as colloquial and familiar as other things we do and are no good for us, like working out or meditating or eating a healthy meal. Like, I dream of a day when there's, you know, a group of employees at a company and they're having lunch and their boss comes over and they're talking about a meeting they're going to have, and they say, okay, awesome, I'll see you there after my happier workout, which, by the way, we have a 5-minute happier workout that I teach. So my dream, my goal is to make happiness and to make the skill of improving our emotional well-being something that millions of people are doing daily. It is part of their daily routine at work and at home. And it's in their colloquial language in the same way as, I'll see you after my workout at the gym, I'll see you after my yoga class, or, well, I'll see you after my happier workout. That's my big goal.
Fantastic. And finally, where can our listeners find you and where can they learn more about what you do?
Of course, happier.com is our website. You can find all sorts of amazing things there, including this 5-minute happier workout I mentioned. You can subscribe to my weekly newsletter, which I write myself. And my book. I should always mention my book.
It's now plug your book.
I forget. plug. Well, it's the most personal and meaningful project I've ever created. So the book is called Happier Now: How to Stop Chasing Perfection and Embrace Everyday Moments, Even the Difficult Ones. And you can buy it at your favorite bookseller, online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And those two will get you started on the journey to boosting your happier skills. Happier.com and Happier Now.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Natalie Kogan. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.